This is Frank Collada, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Collada Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
Soldado, Orso Dia, Consigliere, Capo Tutti Capi. You have Soto Capo is your underboss. I just called him the boss. This is Gunnar Allen Lindblom. Check out my book, To Be a King, at tobeakingnovel.com. You're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. It's good to be here in the Big Dumb Fun Show studio. The beautiful Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm not getting my thoughts straight. I'm going to have to smooth myself out. It's kind of cold outside, and we are actually doing this in the early morning hours. I'll let you know why in a minute. Say hello to the folks out there, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Tonight, we have a very, very special guest coming to you all the way via Skype from Europe. I'd like for you to welcome a fellow mob investigator and documenter and all-around raconteur, David Amoroso. Say hello, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Well, it's good to have you here, folks, and I want you to know, and I want you all to go check out his mafia, organized crime, all kinds of organized crime, not just the La Cosa Nostra mafia, which you know that we kind of focus on here, but other kinds of organized crime, biker gangs, European, Russian mafia, and all kinds of organized crime at www.gangstersinc.org. I'm going to let you do it. David, tell us a little bit about your blog site, your website.
I founded it in 2001. I became interested in the mafia and organized crime from watching The Sopranos, actually, because I was watching the fiction of the side of it, and I was like, what's the true story behind this fictional television show? Because I knew it was based on some real characters, and I decided to read up on them, and that's how my my investigative side was aroused, if you will, and I became a mob buff, and I became reading everything I could about the mafia, and I always have loved writing. I'm a journalist myself. I got a bachelor's degree in journalism, and I decided to why not just set up a website. Back then, in 2001, there wasn't a lot of there weren't a lot of websites dedicated to the mafia or organized crime. You had AmericanMafia.com and you had Jerry Capecchi's website. But that was pretty much it. So I decided, like, you know, I'm going to focus on, as you said, the global organized crime scene, the Russian mafia, the Japanese Yakuza, the Chinese triads, everything and anything. And, basically I've been going strong now for 16 years. So, yeah, it's been awesome.
Oh, that's great. You know, David, and I appreciate what you've done because I've gone to you several times for research. Matter of fact, when I first created my own website, started looking into this, and I mainly have focused on, started off with Kansas City, La Cosa Nostra mafia families, or the mafia family here in Kansas City, and then started branching out. Well, I was able to learn a lot from your website. So I of course, subscribe to it, and take a look at it every once in a while, sometimes just for my own enjoyment. And that website, I want to repeat this one more time, folks. I want you to go to it and check it out. It's www.gangstersinc.org. Remember that. It's not .com. It's .org.
Yeah, if you're listening to this right now, you could actually just surf on over there if you're not driving your car,
right,
if you're home on your computer, and check it out. You have a subscription as well. Like, you can subscribe to Gangland Wire and get on our mail list. They have one as well for Gangsters, Inc.
You can go to Facebook, Twitter.
And so your Facebook, that's Gangsters, Inc. I'm on it, too, but I can't remember all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's Facebook, and then you put the .com and slash, and it's Gangsters, Inc. That's it.
Now, in 2001, other than, say, like, you know, there was the Sopranos, I guess, what other kind of material? There wasn't a lot of other stuff out there, was there? The popularity has certainly grown since you started in 2001.
Yeah, definitely. I think back then you had The Sopranos, and before that, obviously, you had Goodfellas and Casino and, you know, all the big mob movies, Godfather. But as far as The Sopranos was just, it was a weekly show, so it came back every week, and it was sort of like year after year it came back. I just think that, you know, back then people became more interested. I think they were happy with the movies that we had at the time. And now it's like, you know, with the internet, people want new movies, new television series, new podcasts, new websites, new articles. It's nonstop. I think that's really the biggest difference between now and back then. Back then, it was just, you know, just tiny bits of websites, articles. There wasn't really that a lot going on. And then after that, it boomed. And now you have several websites. You have podcasts dedicated to organized crime. There's television. I think there's hardly any television show right now that hasn't gotten like a mob boss character. You know, if you look at Luke Cage, Marvel's new television series on Netflix, or any other show, they all have mob bosses or some kind of reference to Japanese Yakuza or the Chinese triads or the Russian mobsters or Albanian mobsters. So I think, yeah, it definitely has, you know, boomed since then.
Yeah, that's for sure. I've noticed with as I started this in 2013 when I did my film, Gangland Wire, and it was really the backstory behind the movie Casino and the Kansas City end of that investigation. Why, from then until today, I would say the mob interest and the mob Facebook pages and all that have probably, I don't know, quadrupled. There must be, I think there's three or four in Chicago alone that primarily focus on the Chicago outfit. It's just been amazing.
And then you have the reality shows. I mean, the Mob Wives, and, you know, I think you have the Bonanno family, Mitch, who now has his own show as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's the latest one. So I think, you know, we had Growing Up Gotti. It's amazing that these, you know, people who used to operate in the shadows, they basically are coming out into the open.
Oh, now they're becoming personalities for reality shows.
Exactly.
Well, you know, really think about it. They used to be, if you turned around and ratted somebody out and testified against them, you just disappeared for the rest of your life, or your life was in danger. Now we've got our friend Frank Culotta out there in Las Vegas running a Las Vegas mob tour for anybody that wants to come and pay him to drive him around Las Vegas, and he's got about four books out there.
The interesting thing about when you take that ride with Frank Culotta, he always wants to sit in the back seat.
And he wants you to start the car.
Kidding. We don't know that for sure. Yeah.
That's like the old joke that I've told before. My wife doesn't really like it. I'll give a program. And, of course, I used to investigate the mob in Kansas City. And I'll say, you know, my wife, she was really happy when I retired and quit investigating the mob. And then I'll just let a little pause out there, and people are going, well, you know, well, how come? You know, they're waiting for me to say, and I said, well, now she didn't have to go out and start the car every morning when I go to work. She does not like that joke at all.
No, she doesn't like him doing this podcast either.
No, it makes her nervous.
You don't.
Puts me back into it.
I mean, you're lucky, aren't you? I mean, the mafia in the U.S. isn't anywhere near as dangerous as they used to be.
Oh no. There are just a couple of guys around here that make me a little bit nervous, and I know they know that I exist.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do a podcast or a blog in the shadows and remain anonymous. I know we were one time doing some material about the Ku Klux Klan and some white supremacists. That Gary had a great story from when he was on the police force as a sergeant running a tactical squad that broke up a Klan meeting, so to speak, but it was more at a public access TV station. And he was concerned about getting photos out and having our faces out there where people could actually see it because of that. And it doesn't make a lot, didn't make a lot of sense to me, because then the next episode we're talking about Frank Culotta in Vegas and how we're here at the Ice House.
Yeah, so, I mean, if they want me, I guess they'll find me. There's so many pictures of me out there now, and so many ways to find me. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, he did get a scary guy at the in Las Vegas sitting there during his presentation, he said.
I did have one. Oh, well.
Now, what about you, though, David? Since 2001, you've really been putting it up online for people to find, read, share, and... Do you ever find yourself looking over your shoulder?
Well, I mean, I never put my photo on there. So I think that sort of like gave me some extra sense of safety, if you will. The biggest problems I've had actually was just with lawyers who wanted stuff removed from the website because their client didn't like being on there. Several times I've had like a message from Google that they said, you know, that they removed me from certain search results to certain pages. So that's pretty much the biggest problem that I've had. I've had some threats via email, but I think everyone has those. You know, people, there's some fanboys out there who don't like when you write about certain guys or you're critical of certain people. So they come up and they, especially on Facebook, actually, they come up and they threaten you, but it's just typical stuff. You know, you rat cucks, you know, bleep, bleep. You know, I don't know if I can curse on here, but It's that kind of stuff, you know, and that's really, it doesn't come across as that threatening. It's more like, oh, here's another fanboy who's doing that stuff. And I've actually met some real criminals and gang bosses in Europe here. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, usually they don't really care about what's being written as long as it's correct and as long as it's not exposing any of their current day-to-day operations. I mean, they're very strict about that, of course. But I think as long as you behave in a certain way that it's, they know they can't bullshit with you, then they won't pull anything. I think once you start becoming their friend or once you start becoming a tool for them and you double cross them or you do something that hurts their business, they treat you as a friend who ratted them out, and that's a problem. But if you treat them as sources and if you treat them as, you know, people that know that you're a journalist, I tend to say that they tend to, you know, behave in a normal way, if you will. I mean, you always have to be cautionary, but, you know, in general, I feel like I've had a lucky run with these guys.
Well, certainly since 2001 to here now in 2017,
yeah.
What comes to mind is an incident that happened here in Kansas City with myself. I was working at my other part-time job, Chubby's on Broadway, one morning. And that was a business that was owned by a local family, the Labruzzos. And Uncle Frank is a nephew to Tuffy DeLuna.
Who's the underboss of the Kansas City family.
Yeah. And I had ridden up on the elevator with him in the federal building years ago when he was being taken to court. And Frank's a great guy. And he runs a lunch truck. And there was a story that Gary had mentioned Kansas City Star reporter had come along and said, "Hey, I'm doing some research. Can I talk with you?" And Gary mentioned it in passing, like he may when we'd meet, and I didn't really think much of it. And then this story came out at 6 a.m. There's Frank sitting at the lunch counter reading the paper. And there's a story about one of his uncles who he thought committed suicide. They told him when he was 5 years old. And there was another officer who was a detective, like a plainclothes detective, Richard, who was also reading the story right there at the lunch counter. Oddly enough, he comes in every morning as well. And he spun the paper around and pointed Gary's name out. And, you know, and Uncle Frank was kind of, you could see that he was, you know, this upset him. And he kind of looked to me as if I was somebody who had some kind of inside information, that I had some knowledge beforehand of something like this. And, I don't know if anybody ever does that with you, where these guys think you have inside sources, so you have information maybe. But, you know, in those kind of moments, I don't know what you do, but I know what I do. And I tell Uncle Frank that if I'd known anything, I certainly would have told him in advance.
You'd rat me out, huh?
Now, I would have said, "Hey, there's this article coming out in the paper." Well, I think the part of it is because they look at me like, because I do this podcast, that I'm kind of, I am this inside source. And so yeah. I should know this stuff because we do this podcast. And quite frankly, most of the time Gary comes into the studio and hands me, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 pages of paper and we go at it. So my my lead time isn't always as much as I'd like it to be. But you ever find that that happens where people expect you to have some kind of inside knowledge because you've been doing this for so long?
Yeah, yeah, that does happen. You know, not a lot. I think because I'm so global, I think people, the people that I do meet, you know, there's other reporters doing stuff on the local scene, like, you know, Gary and you with Kansas City. You know, I might write about Kansas City once in a while, but people will not look at me like I'm the insider on Kansas City. And I think that goes for a lot of the other stories as well. I think there's, you know, if I write something about Chinese organized crime, there's going to be people out there who know more about that than I do. And it did happen, though, when I met one British drug boss. I met him, and he was telling a story about going to this charity event, and he wanted a nice suit, and he was looking in his closet, and he pulled out one of his jackets, and he said, you know, there was £20,000 in there, which is a lot of money. And he said he had forgotten all about that, and I was like, my reaction was the reaction of any poor journalist who's not making any money. Like, yeah, right. You know, that you can't be serious about that. And I remember his face had switched because he was being serious and I didn't believe him. And this was just a regular story, but he just kind of flipped out on me because I didn't believe him. It wasn't scary per se, but I was worried about, you know, losing a source or losing someone who might share some information with me or would explain certain stuff to me. But it was just a simple misunderstanding, really, and me not believing him created this tension that was, it was interesting at that time, and luckily everything went okay. But that was one instance where this had nothing to do with me sharing inside information or being asked to, but it was a situation where I was like, oh, damn, this might end up causing me some trouble down the road. And luckily it didn't, but that was one of the instances where I felt like a bit threatened and a bit over some, you know, minor thing, really, because I didn't believe his story, you know. And then actually he kept on going with it because he later actually sent me some photos of cash, piles of cash that he had at his house, like later that night. So it was all in good fun later on, but it really, I guess, hurt his feelings, if you will. So that was just a weird situation to be in.
David, you and Aaron both just experienced what I call the dual personality of these professional criminals. On one hand, they are charming, you know, it always, you get more, attract more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. But when you quit attracting flies with the honey, then sometimes you got to go to the vinegar, and it's like an act that they know how to go into in order to dominate and manipulate people. They can go from being your buddy and acting like you're the greatest thing in the world to that death stare and that maybe almost like a fake kind of a put upon anger that then they need to get you under your control, has been my experience with these professional criminal.
No, and I don't know that Frank is a professional criminal. I don't think he is at all, and not in my experience with him. Yeah, I definitely told Gary that story later on, and I said, hey, if you happen to talk to another reporter and you think there's going to be a story come out, let me know, and I would let them know in advance, because in some ways I think that perception that we have this inside information is worth propagating.
That's true. Well, you know,
because you got to come for the source if you're going to get material that people want to find, right? They're not going to go to your site because they can find it everywhere else.
That's true. All right, enough of all that. Let's get into what we kind of came here to talk about. And
the Cray brothers.
Well,
no,
two things. You know, David, and I know you're not like an expert on the Cray brothers, but I'm always been interested in the Cray brothers personally. Most Americans don't know anything about the Cray brothers, unless you're a real organized crime professional criminal aficionado, shall we say. But Ronald and Reginald Cray, in England, and they seemed to dominate all the London-based rackets, and they were particularly interesting, I thought. One of them was Gay, I believe, which in that world, in the United States, that homie don't play that, as we used to say. You saw what happened to the Gay dude in The Sopranos, and that would be pretty much, across the board in the United States in those crime families. But what can you tell our listeners about the famous Cray brothers?
Well, we were just talking about the two sides of these gangsters, and I think that the Cray twins, they had this down to a T, because they ran several clubs in London. You know, they bought up nightclubs and bars and stuff like that, and then they start running a protection racket. So they would just extort money from all the clubs owners in the street. But because they owned these nightclubs, the superstars, the football players, and the movie stars and television stars, they would come in to party, and the newspaper people would take pictures of all these stars coming to their clubs. And naturally, the Cray twins would be on those photos as well, and became sort of like a celebrity gangster twin couple, if you will. And, you know, with these celebrities, they would be, you know, very charming, and they would be funny, and, you know, they would all have a jolly old time. But these guys were ultra violent, and some would say a bit crazy, and they weren't as organized as the mafia back in America or in Italy, but they did, you know, because of their reputation, they just ran these criminal records in London. So that was pretty much their game. And they were an interesting couple, really, because, you know, as brothers, it doesn't happen too often that you have two brothers at the helm of an organized crime group. But they were one of many in London, actually. But because of their high profile, they became, at least in terms of media exposure, they became top dogs. And it's actually what brought them down in the end. But these guys were charming and everything. And then they would go out and slap some people around and extort some money and maybe do a hijacking or a robbery. And that's how they made their money. And they could invest that in the club scene. So that was really how they made their money and how they got their reputation.
So they had like an organization, you know, like maybe some capos, some underbosses that would have a crew who would go out and take care of loan shark collections or extortions, or another crew that would maybe go do some hijackings, and then they would set them up with fencing opportunities, that kind of a thing, kind of your normal organized crime family we know in the United States?
No, nothing like that. No, they were just a crew of, it depends on who you talk to. I think, you know, I've read several books about the Crays, and, you know, some would describe them as being pretty organized, and others would say that they were just a ragtag group of guys sitting around in a bar looking for the biggest opportunity to make money. And I think the truth is somewhere in between. I think especially if you look at their rise, I think that in the beginning they were just, you know, sitting around looking for opportunities. And as their power grew and their influence grew, they probably had guys, you know, doing the extortion runs for them to pick up the money and maybe organize the robbery, and they got a taste of it. But it was never as organized crime in the U.S. or Sicily or, you know, anywhere else, because it was just those two guys. And they had some people that they trusted with some business. But mostly they were very hands-on, because that's, you know, in Europe there's different rules and there's different ways of organizing, I guess. And I think that in, I would compare them more to the Westies in Hell's Kitchen in New York, where you have two guys on top with a bunch of guys underneath. And pretty much everyone is doing their job and their part. But the Cray twins are just, I guess, running a small crew. That would be more precise, actually.
Okay, thanks. That makes a lot of sense to me. They actually became so famous because of what you initially said. They got all that press attention. That's why everybody knows who the Cray brothers are.
Exactly. They know because of the nightclubs. They controlled the nightclubs there, and they bought, you know, they invested their, you know, ill-gotten gains in there. And that's how they got an in with all these celebrities. And because of their charming side, they were able to, you know, continue that relationship. And as time grew and as they grew more power hungry, if you will, things started escalating and there would be more fights and more violence. And a lot of these celebrities would realize what was going on, and it would eventually, you know, there would be a break between these people. But by then, you know, the newspapers would be filled with their photos. And I think because they're high profile, I think police as well as the media would label them as the kings of organized crime simply because they were the ones most visible. I think if you look at some of the other guys out there, you had the Richardson brothers who were also in London. I don't know too much about them, but I do know that there were several other crews in London that were operating at the time at a much more sophisticated level at the time. And, you know, they got away with it. And afterwards, years later, decades later, you had the Adams family, which is a very funny name when you think about the TV show, but it was actually again, these were brothers. They formed a crew, and they dominated organized crime in London, and they actually were into drug dealing, robberies, hijackings, contract killings, the whole lot. And these guys were a lot more professional than the Cray Twins, but because they were so low-key and people didn't know them, they sort of like skated under the radar. And I think that's really the difference between the Cray Twins and any other criminal or gangster or gang boss in London from that time on. And if you look at the organized crime in the United Kingdom, each story, it doesn't matter if it's in Scotland or it's in Ireland, they all have this kind of historic story about their own local crime boss standing up to the Cray Twins, like meeting one of them or being subject to a possible robbery and then turning it on them. And it's sort of like to bolster their own reputation. So some of these guys might have actually started the gossip themselves, and other people might have just started gossiping to, you know, enhance the reputation of their local crime boss. But that is actually the power of these Cray Twins, where no one really thought they were as powerful as they were, but because of the press coverage, everyone just fell for it. And, you know, the American Mafia, in the beginning, they actually paid respect to the Cray Twins as well, because they felt like, you know, these guys, they have the reputation, they own these nightclubs in London, and we want to run a casino here, so pay our respect. But pretty soon, once they started running the casinos, they realized that these guys were pretty much loose cannons, and they weren't as sophisticated as they might have seemed. You know, like you said, you know, if they ran organized crime in London, you would expect them to have, you know, divisions and capos and underboss and people who ran shit, and they would be professional, but they were far from it. Actually have one story where this is a story about the American Mafia running casinos in London. So they were set up there, and you had Cray Twin it was, but they were running a casino in London, expensive, it's a luxurious place, and you had George Raft, the former actor who played several gangsters in these gangster movies back in the day. This was in the 1960s, by the way, and he ran the casino. He was sort of like a front guy for the American Mafia. At one point, Ronnie Cray walked in, and he was starting an argument pretty fast with his father and son couple who were at the casino. Now, he was going to, like, you know, beat them up, and, you know, he was very aggressive. And at one point, George Raft pulls one of Cray's associates aside, and he says, "Has Ronnie met the Blade yet?" And the essence of that sentence was that Raft was asking if he should put this Genovese crime family mobster on Ronnie Cray. The Blade was a nickname for Charles Turin, who was part of the Genovese crime family and who oversaw that casino. And he was there to protect their interests. And he was going to sort Ronnie Cray out because at that point, George Raft had no clue how they should handle this kind of situation. So in the end, it was all resolved and nothing went wrong. But it sort of like indicates that, you know, despite what people may think of the Crays, they might not have been as powerful as they seemed at the time. You know, and even back then, at the height of their power, people would still see them as loose cannons, and they would, If they continued their drunken behavior, their aggressive behavior, they might have been taken out by an American gangster overseas.
Yeah, they probably would have. That fits. That is totally logical with things I've seen here in the United States For example, if a mob boss here in Kansas City wants to extort some money from a club or start moving in on a club, he'll send two or three young guys who are associates and send them in, and they'll just start fights. And then the mob guy can send another guy around and say, you know, hey, we can stop these fights, but, you know, you got to take care of us, but we'll stop all these problems. And that's probably what the Cray brothers started to do, the Cray twins started to do with that particular casino. They just bid off, they went into the wrong casino, and it sounded like they backed down pretty quick when Raph dropped the name of the Blade and they understood who the Blade was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the mob started working with them a little bit, but it was sort of like they paid them a little bit just to keep quiet. But, you know, the mob at that point was so powerful, and they still had all this talent, if you will, from, like, back in the day. These were the mafia was in its prime at that time, and they had so many killers walking around and so many connections, you know, on a global scale, that it was no problem for them to take out this London crime boss.
Yeah, interesting. Tell me this, and then we're going to go to a break, and we'll break this up into two episodes. We want to come back and talk about the American La Cosa Nostra's mafia influence in other European and I think Caribbean casinos.
Kind of gives us a nice intro into it in terms of like our discussion about the Cray brothers and the casinos that they had in England that they had the American mob come over to help out with or operate.
Well, the Cray brothers didn't have them come over. The
American mob came over.
Right. They were over there. So I want one last insight into England, and then we'll go to break, and we'll come back and talk about other European casinos and American mob's influence over there. And that would be like in London. This is kind of there's no stupid questions, as they say. Like in England or in London, was there any kind of a local Sicilian-based La Cosa Nostra family, or somebody who had immigrated, say, the turn of the century and early 1900s from Sicily to England and rose up to have some kind of a small crime family?
I think there was. I have to say, I haven't really did any research on those. I couldn't find anything as fast as I was looking, but I do know that, you know, that there are several Sicilian gangsters who emigrated to London or to the UK and eventually set up base there, but it was more of a connected to their home country. So they would smuggle drugs into the UK, that kind of stuff. It wasn't like in the US where you actually had a stable crime family with its origins in Sicily or in Naples and then starting over in England. That hasn't happened, but they have, you know, Europe is a small place because people can drive anywhere. It's sort of like the U.S. in a way. And so you have a lot of these gangsters that would go to other countries without necessarily, you know, growing root as they would in New York City when they came over. So you would have crime families there maybe, but not in the way that you had them in the United States. It was all just a bunch of guys, and it never really grew into La Cosa Nostra in like they have in the U.S.
Now, it sounds like they, if they were up in England or anywhere else in Europe and they were out of Sicily, they probably remained part of a Sicilian family or a Camorra family down there. So interesting. All right. Well, we're going to go to break now and come back next time with a second episode of this interesting talk with our good friend from Europe, David Amoruso, who has his own mob blog, and it's a really interesting one. If you think of it right now, folks, you're sitting there and you're listening on your phone, flip over to your Safari, your
Chrome browser,
and go to www.gangstersinc.org. That's www.gangstersinc.org. It's filled with great articles by David, and you'll even find one by me on there. I wrote about the formation of the American secret police, shall we say, in the United States, and it was formed to fight these traveling nationally connected criminals like La Cosa Nostra. We shared information with each other police departments across the United States. It's called LEIU. Aaron, what do you got any other questions here? Quick questions before we head
out? I was
out?
Just going to ask. I mean, David had been doing this since 2001. If you go to the site and you is there material that, I mean, you can subscribe and get on a mail list, I imagine. But the how far back can you go through the archive if you're interested in just reading?
You can go all the way back. You can. I try to organize everything into several overview pages. You have a Yakuza section, you have a section on the Russian Mafia, and I've listed every article that I ever put on the website. It's on all these pages. So you can find pretty much any page that I ever was put out on the website on these section pages.
Wow, that's a lot of material.
It is. It's a ton of material. So you guys will have an endless source of maybe new and maybe a different look at information you already knew, but a lot of new information, particularly about the Yakuza and the Russian Mafia, I got a feeling, and other European influences, because our good friend David is living over there in Europe and from the Netherlands, I think you said. I'm going to make my public service announcement that I always do. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org, or call them at 816-361-5900. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks need to go to gangstersinc.org and subscribe and share that website as well with the folks that you know that love true crime. And then, of course, go to ganglandwire.com, subscribe, share, and support the program by making a donation. Put a hit out on our donate button, and also rent or buy the movie, the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon, and download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City and pick up the new book that Gary just released, available on Kindle.
Leaving Vegas, How the FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. And I have a new one.
You got a new book?
I have a new one. It's going to be a short book. It's going to be available on Kindle, or I'll send you a PDF file. If you subscribe to my website, I will send you a link to get a free Kindle, if you have a Kindle, or a free PDF of my new short book on surveillance methods and tactics, and how I was able to use a lot of those, some personal experiences using surveillance over the years. Everybody, let's say goodnight. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, David.
And good night.
Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respect where you refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer will make time to incriminate me.
Yeah.
We'll get started again. I'll make this into two episodes. When we come back, what you want to talk about was about the American mob's foreign influence, and so we'll go into that.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, that's what I thought. We set it back up, introduce David. And
yeah, we'll kind of set it back up and go back over just a little bit about what we did last time. We learned about the Cray twins and
the Blade.
The Blade and La Cosa Nostra. And
I thought that was my nickname.
England, yeah, that is your nickname. Aaron was robbed one night on his way home from
Starbucks.
From Starbucks and street robbery, and they didn't get very much. The idiot left his, he had his backpack with a computer in it, and he didn't ask to look at his backpack. Aaron says, well, all I've got's like a Starbucks cup and a dollar here.
Some change.
and change. No folding money even. I had
$1 and like $1.73. Okay.
And so we did this 7-part interview with this guy who had been a skyjacker in the early 70s. And this was kind of a strange guy, but you can imagine he parachuted out of a plane with $500,000 and got away with it for a couple of weeks and told too many people. spent 40 years in the penitentiary and then came out, and he is now working with another guy to write a book, and he did a podcast with us. And
he Google searched his own name and found an episode that we had done about D.B. Cooper.
Yeah.
And the copycats that included Martin.
So when we had to go to another city, went down to St. Louis to interview him, and when we got there, he had this big, one of those big, wicked-looking folding knives laying on his coffee table, and I'm thinking, oh, boy, what are we getting into here? But as we get to talking, he says, oh, and he said, I have a gift for you guys. And he brought out two more of these big, wicked-looking folding pocket knives in brand-new containers of those plastic
shrink wrap
containers, and handed them to us. So, but Aaron didn't have his knife that night.
Yeah.
We nicknamed him the Blade.
I thought my friend Elliot 3 didn't need me the Blade because I make cutting comments.
Yeah, you may. If you can't figure it out, Aaron's also a comedian. Can you get him any gigs over there in Europe? Get him on a European tour? You know,
you know who's really, really popular?
Come over to Amsterdam.
You know who's really popular, probably, if you know anything about comedy, would be Doug Stanhope.
Oh, yeah.
Doug Stanhope. Actually, although he's from the East Coast, he started in Vegas and he moved down to Phoenix and was working at a club there called Finny Bones. I think just actually working working the door or whatever. And I had started doing comedy there in Phoenix as well. So we all kind of started in at about the same time. We knew each other. I've interviewed him a few times but never done many gigs with him. Pablo Francisco would be another one.